Now we'll move to a hot topic called Chinese rice, which is a hot topic all over the world. What is taking place there and what will take place in the future? I put up this lecture with the help of Agnus Madison's arguments on Chinese economic performance in the long run. The first version was written in 1998, then from 2008. Agnus Madison is a world-famous economic historian who has been looking at long-term trends, how different economies have performed in the past and how they probably may perform in the future. So here we take a short look at the past of China. Between 1820 and 1952, the world economy made enormous progress by any previous yardstick. World product rose more than eightfold and world per capita income threefold. US per capita income rose nearly ninefold, European income fourfold, and Japanese more than threefold. That is until 1952. After that, the whole world economy started to expand even more rapidly than before that. In other Asian countries except Japan, economic progress was very modest, but in China, per capita product actually fell. And China's share of world GDP fell from a third to 1/20. Its real per capita income fell from 90% to less than a quarter of the world average. It's the period when colonial powers conquered bits of China. Russia from the north, Britain from the south, France also from the south, and Japan also came well from the east, and forced China into various kinds of unfair economic relationships. And this is a history, this drastic fall from an exalted position to the bottom of the world is something that has left deep wounds. The Chinese social psychology and Chinese political psychology. It is remembered, and this now is a moment when they think that they have a right again to rise to the top and correct the historical wrong done on them. Why, what did happen after 1949? But a situation where the country now became practically also independent. It had been independent nominally before, but now also practically. And foreign powers were kicked out. There was internal order in China, a new elite, without any too traditional links to old economic systems. And very reactive nationalism, anti-Western, and communist ideology. During 1952-1978, there was actually a major acceleration of growth. A socialist system can perform quite well, especially in case of poor countries. The GDP rose three times, per capita income by 80%. Yet, because China was closed, however well it did, it grew slower than the world average. Chinese per capita growth was only 2.3% and world average 2.6% a year. So relatively, China tended to stay very poor at this period. Then comes Deng Xiaoping with his reforms in 1978. He had been studying in France when he was a young man. He had been to a capitalistic country, and he knew how a capitalistic country functioned. He was a communist, but he was able to see that capitalism has some good characteristics. And he introduced these to China. So, for instance, farm households regained control and management of their land. The big people's communes, where all people in the countryside had been collected, they were breaking down, and families regained the right to use their own land. The result was a huge expansion of small-scale industries. The non-state sector began to grow with low labor costs and virtually no social charges. At the same time, lots of foreign companies from a big number of foreign countries started to invest to China to benefit from the cheap labor that was available there. So China became now integrated into the world economy. And there are few countries where economic growth and economic development has taken place so easily as in China. Huge amount of investment, capital poured into China. So China has not had any kind of debt problems, especially in terms of outside of China. And Chinese currency has been able to stay steady throughout this period. And Chinese per capita GDP rose from 22 to 74% of the world level. And its share of world GDP rose from 5 to 15% between 1978 to 2003, meaning extremely rapid growth, more than offsetting the period of slow growth during the Maoist period. What can we expect about the next quarter century? Well, let's take first a look at these figures. Chinese growth rates during the past 10 years. 10.1%, 11.3%, 12.7%, 14.2%, 9.6, 9.2, 10.4, 9.2, and so on. This year, because this is a recession year in the whole world economy, Chinese growth is also expected to go down to 7.8%. Be very high in historical standards, world standards. For China, this is slow. But perhaps China has now reached a certain level where its national economy will grow no more than 10% a year, but lower. The expectation is that also in the future is that Chinese per capita will continue to grow, but the pace will go down. Everybody does expect this. These figures are for the national economy, and these figures are per capita figures. So per capita, meaning how much statistically individual Chinese will become richer, would be 5.6% a year to 2010. Well, we are there already. These are Madison's predictions. These were easily fulfilled. Perhaps 5.6 to the year 2020 and 3.6 to 2030. In 2030, Chinese, on average, are expected to be on the same per capita level and Western Europe and Japan were in 1990 is the period when the catch-up process, the fast growth, ceased both in Japan and in Western European countries. For Western European, many of them did that already earlier. But we are, because let's think, for instance, about Finland. Finland has not been growing so fast after 1990. In 20 years, we are a bit richer than we were 20 years ago, but not too much. So if China is able to achieve this, they will be in a quite well-to-do level in 2030, which is not very far away. Chinese population now 1 billion, 300 million and some. The population growth rate is 0.47%, not very big anymore. And its fertility rate is 1.54, which is very low. It's somewhere in the, let's say, southern or central European levels. It's lower than in Finland. Finland is somewhere 1.8. Fertility rate means how many children are born to a woman on average. This means that because the population is not growing very much, the wealth of Chinese people can continue growing fairly well, even though the economic growth or the big economy goes down. But it also means that in the future, China will have a huge number of old people. After some 20 years, China will have to worry how to pay the pensions of its old population. And its growth is expected to go to the levels where it is now in Europe or also in Japan. 1 point something. China is the first big country that has grown this far and this high. Let's take a simple glimpse at Japanese growth. 1952 to 1955, 8.6%, 9.1%, 9.7%, 12.9%, and so on. So Chinese do not like this comparison. They want to see their country as the first big success. Those who have studied Japanese economic history simply see a second one coming along. And of course, there has been very, very many smaller countries that have been able to achieve this in the past. 7.2% growth is important, because if something grows by 7.2% a year, it will become twice bigger in 10 years. And 11.6 is also important, because if something grows that high in annually, in 5 years, it will become twice bigger. And in Japan, in 1966-70, when it was growing by 12.9%, it meant that it became 1,024 times bigger in 40 years. And magnificent ideas were speculated about Japanese future, when it will become the biggest economy in the world, and its culture will flow throughout the rest of the world. This never happened. This kind of high growth does not last long in any single country. It will slow down sooner or later. And when I go to China nowadays, when it is in the period of high growth, I feel the same kind of exalted pride and expectations of a good future that I could feel in Japan still in the 1980s when I first time went there. What does this mean in practice, this high growth? We have here two high-rise buildings from different period. The old high-rise building is now old, being demolished, and new ones are being set up on it. China is urbanizing very rapidly. People from the countryside are moving to towns and cities. And lots of construction is taking place. Well, these photos are from Shanghai, which may be the hottest place in terms of economy in China nowadays, but similar things are taking place also elsewhere. And then the Chinese will live in this kind of new, very clean, very nice environment and drink Coca-Cola when walking along the streets. And the new Shanghai railway station, very bright, very clean, very efficient, very postmodern. And so much is new in China nowadays, new, glittering, clean, that well, you have to go there to see it. Of course, we still have lots of poor people also in China, but much of Chinese are nowadays middle class, which we can see also all over the world in tourism, because they are now getting out by the millions, and soon perhaps in tens of millions abroad on touristic trips. Angus Madison's idea was that China will overtake USA before 2015. And by 2030 it will account for 1/4 of the world GDP. And in 2030, whole Asia, including Japan, will account for 53% of world GDP, while the United States and European Union counted together will have only 33%, meaning that the economic center of the world will move to Eastern Asia. And that's why it still looks like these predictions will come through. 2015, for the overtaking of USA, may be a bit too early. The Economist journal calculated, well, now there's a big debate about this matter, and the Economist calculated what has happened thus far and what will happen in the future. China has already overtaken the USA in many, many ways. Mobile phones, the number of mobile phones in 2001, the amount of beer being drank in 2002, net foreign assets, meaning how much capital you have minus your debts, 2003, carbon dioxide emissions, 2006, well, big production means also big pollution, and China is a polluted place, which you can feel especially in winter in big Chinese cities. In exports, 2007, manufacturing output, 2010, energy consumption, 2010, car sales, 2010, it's now the world's biggest car market, and patents, also 2010. This is important, because this means that Chinese are no more only importing technology, but they are quite much creating it by themselves. Not all in the high end. It's still, patents are still being made also in the textile industries and so on. But they are doing them a lot. In the future, retail sales 2014. So not only in cars, but also in general, China will become the biggest market in the world, consumer market. Imports 2014, firms in Fortune 5. Fortune is also an American journal which keeps a list of the 5 biggest companies in the world. At the moment, USA has the biggest number of companies in this list, but USA, 3 years from now, is expected to overtake it. GDP. Purchasing power parities 2016, not 15 like Angus Madison predicted, but perhaps 2016. And in market exchange rate based calculation 2018, and this is very near future. Barack Obama, will be the last US president to able to be the ruler of the biggest economy of the earth. He will still continue being the president of the most powerful country in the world, because that is a different aspect. But biggest economy will most likely be China from that time on. Oil consumption 2021, consumer spending 2013, and defense spending 2015. Defense spending is also important strategically. USA is now spending most money in the world, and it has the strongest military in the world. If Chinese defense spending goes above that of USA, that does not mean that China would immediately become stronger than USA. It starts from a much lower level. It has decades still to catch up and build, but it is, and not so slowly, catching up with USA also in this matter. China also has, of course, problems. Energy is the biggest of them. How to get enough energy, oil, gas, electricity, to feed this big industrial machine. Chinese electricity supply had become 10 times bigger since 1978 to 2005. And much of this is nuclear energy. It has its problems, but you have to use what you can use. Private cars will be a problem. In 2006, there were 19 million private cars. Now, as China is the biggest car market in the world, if there are 300 million cars in China in 2030, it will be difficult to drive. Chinese big cities are already very congested, and we don't know whether there's space for that many cars at that time. But that would resemble the European Union level in 1990. China is becoming energy efficient, but it is not yet so much. Japan or South Korea are much more energy efficient than China is. 73, China needed 0.64 tons of oil to produce 100 US dollars of DGP, should be GDP. I have a mistake there. In 2003, it was only 0.22 tons, and that was better than USA on average. And probably in 2030, it will be 0.11, a level where Japan, for instance, is nowadays. But most energy nowadays comes from coal. China is importing gas and oil, but coal is still the biggest source of energy. About 20,000 coal mines in China, employing 6 million coal workers. And Chinese coal is dirtier than world average. Especially in winter, you feel it in big cities, especially in northern big cities, where you burn lots of it. You feel the air, even without wind. Beijing, in a bright January morning, 2009, minus 20 degrees cold. The Chinese are no more heating with small heaters in every single family. They now have this kind of heat factories, which can heat lots of houses around. But in the future, they will have to build even bigger ones far away from the center. You still have lots of smoke in Beijing. This urban middle-class housing in Guilin, Guangxi, southern China. Nice new apartment houses. And there we have housewives going home from the shop, bags full of food in them. They are nice places. This brand new Buick XL made in Shanghai, bought by this family in 2007. If you can afford, you move to town, you live in a nice apartment, and then you buy the car. In the 1950s, there used to be an American dream, a middle-class American dream, of the house and the car, and a nice family. And this is what is taking place now in China. The Chinese dream is coming true in their daily lives. And they are tourists. Foreigners come to China. It's quite easy to travel there nowadays. It helps if you know some Chinese, even if you can read some of the characters, but you can do also without. And within China, they are traveling by the hundreds or millions. Other problems, the legal system of private property rights. The legal system nowadays is set up so that private enterprises can flourish. But private individuals are not yet too well protected by the system. The companies tend to win quite often because companies are important for the state and individuals are not as important for the state, unless they are important individuals, but that is a different thing. Land is in state or collective property, can be also the prefectures and so on. Peasants can have 30-year leases and urban residents 70-year leases. This inhibits private entrepreneurship, especially in the countryside, because you don't necessarily want to invest too much if you don't know surely that you and your sons or daughters can own the land also in the future. Regional inequalities are extreme. The welfare level between the poorest place and the richest place is at least 10 times or more than 10 times. And the system is very unequal, especially towards country people, because all people have to be registered somewhere. And you are not able freely to move to cities and register yourself there. There are ways to do it. Getting specific employment, getting married, paying money to certain places. Poor people are not able to do this. So they are in the cities, at least 100 million of them, moving workers are in Chinese big cities. But without access to the city welfare system, education, housing, medical care, and so on. And you can see construction workers, males, sleeping there on roadsides or under bridges, especially when it is warm. And healthcare and education are nowadays partly on a de facto capitalistic basis. You have to pay for good education and you pay for doctors. You pay for medical care. Especially if you want good quality services, you always go and pay, and that is quite expensive. And again, out of the reach of the poorest people. So there are lots of internal tensions within China, but as long as, on average, the whole thing is getting richer and richer by the year, the future is bright. The future is optimistic. And this has not turned into internal big conflicts. There are small conflicts in China all over, but there's no revolutionary movement in there. This also connected to the problem of gender imbalance, because many more boys are born than girls. They can, with ultrasound, look what is the sex of the fetus. And if it is a girl, sometimes it is taken away. And it's tens of millions of females less in China than there should be. Which also will add to the fact that in the future, not very many babies will be born in China. Recently, China has become a wife importing country. Especially Vietnamese wives are exported to China. There's a huge market for women, marriage-aged women there, because there are so many bachelors. But there's also one problematic element here, because in the countryside, there are a number of at least hundreds of thousands of young males who are not able to marry because they are poor, and who don't have actually any kind of good education, because their parents have not been able to pay for their education. And they are now outside of the national indoctrination system. In case the Chinese economic growth would stop, they would be a potential for revolutionary or criminal activity. No education, poor, and no family ties. Young men in this situation have always been dangerous in the history of humankind. Income equalities, rich people can have expensive weddings. Here's a couple, and they can hire a person, professional photographer, to take photos of them. And then there's probably a laborer somewhere from the countryside sleeping on the bench. They normally sleep in this kind of places. This is from Beijing. Somebody has had money to buy a Audi, which is an expensive car. And among these wee things, labor families are living. So poverty and riches meet each other quite regularly. And this kind of housing will not be very warm when it is minus 20 degrees outside. But people can survive there. Finally, about the concept of the peaceful rise of China. The peaceful rise of China is an expression that should not be used by Chinese diplomats or politicians. In 2003, the Prime Minister Wen Jiabao used it once in a meeting in ASEAN and once in the USA, just to experiment what will come out if he says so. Because Chinese want to rise in the world, and everybody knows that they are rising. What does happen if you take this concept openly into use? You have peaceful rise in front of it, but the rest of the world notices that Chinese are now talking proudly about themselves. Threatening images emerge immediately in international discussion. So from 2004 onwards, the President Hu Jintao and then the rest of the administration and so on started to use the concept of peaceful development of China. So this is the politically correct term in China nowadays. These two will step out in March next year. Whether the new leadership will devise some new kind of concepts will be seen. Those of you who listen to my lecture a year, 2 years, perhaps 3 years after this, may know the new expressions, but I don't know them yet. And this was it about the rise of China.